Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books and Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and I have the pleasure today to talk to the author of Red State Revolt, The Teacher's Strikes and Working Class Politics. The author is Eric Blanc, and the publisher of this book is Verso. I have the pleasure to have Eric on the phone today. Eric, how are you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you for coming on, sharing the book, and sharing this super, super timely subject. Before we get to it, you have a pretty interesting background that you bring to this material. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. Where have you been prior to coming to this material, and where are you now?
Sure. So I grew up in a labor family. My mom was actually the president of the teachers union in San Francisco, and I grew up going to picket lines, and I became a public school teacher in the San Francisco Bay Area for 8 years. And that really was the background that ultimately led me to write this book about the teacher strikes. But the reason I was able to write the book about the teacher strikes was also that I happened to have stopped being a teacher about a year and a half ago to be a graduate student at NYU in sociology. So I had a little bit of more flexibility to go travel around with the strike wave that has popped off. So it's that combination of things that really, I think, lended itself towards me being able to talk with the teachers and the organizers on the ground, because they knew I had a similar background. I've been an education organizer and a radical organizer for a while, so I was able to engage with them, and I think in a different way than otherwise I might have been able to.
Yeah, you also bring your academic background to this as well. Why don't you talk maybe a little bit about where you are academically speaking?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm at NYU in sociology. I study social movements, and in particular, one of the interesting aspects of the strikes is that it's brought labor back, hopefully within the scholarly world and within sociology, as something of interest, because for a long time it's really been more or less overlooked. You know, folks are doing work on it, but it's definitely relatively marginal. And I think hopefully now with the strikes, we're going to see more scholarly research about labor, about striking in particular, and, you know, the red state strikes, hopefully, more specifically.
Yeah, I wonder if we could maybe start our conversation talking a little bit about kind of the political and the legal context into which your subject matter and the book is really placed. You focus here on red states, not blue states, and that matters for what it means for unions and teacher groups to participate in politics. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. That is, what are the political circumstances that teachers that are organized as unions face in a red state versus the typical blue state? And we'll then talk more later about what that means for the strategies they use. Maybe you could start there.
Sure. The first thing I would say is it's just worth noting that part of the book really does try to challenge the relevance of the blue state, red state narrative, insofar as there's a level of superficiality to the way that people talk about these states. because West Virginia, for instance, was up until very recently a blue state. So just with that caveat, I think the question you raise is a very important one, which is to say that the political circumstances in particular in the places where you saw the strikes pop off in 2018, West Virginia, then Arizona and Oklahoma, North Carolina, you know, these are states in which union density is much lower than in a state like California or New York. They're right-to-work states, and public sector strikes are illegal. That's, again, not actually specific to quote-unquote red states. In fact, the vast majority of states in the country, public sector workers do not have the right to strike. But there's definitely a confluence of these legal structures combined with the hegemony of the Republican Party on a statewide level that created a circumstance in which the types of normal integrative labor relations, which have prevented strikes in a lot of parts of the country, because if you have collective bargaining but not the right to strike, it's understandable that a lot of unions will, you know, go through the institutional channels. These channels barely existed and in some ways didn't exist at all in a lot of these states. It's just why the way the movement developed was very explosive. It was almost volcanic because there was very little infrastructure through which anything other than mass protests and strikes could have forced the, you know, public employers to the bargaining table.
Yeah, you just alluded to the specific places that you study, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about those, your choice of them, so how you decided on these versus others. Is it primarily driven by the fact that the most important places where these strikes were happening? But what about Arizona and Oklahoma, North Carolina, and one other that I'm forgetting? Tell us about that set that forms the cases that you're looking at here.
So the book really focuses on three cases, West Virginia, then Oklahoma, then Arizona. And the reason I focus on those three is that these were the most important walkouts and strikes in 2018. And in some ways, they were the only real strikes, which is to say there was one-day walkouts and in some places two-day walkouts in Colorado, in North Carolina, in Kentucky. But in West Virginia, Oklahoma, and Arizona, these were real strikes, which is to say that workers went out, shut down the schools, raised their demands, and were not willing to go back to school until their demands were met. And so they were much longer, they were much more contentious, and they generated a level of political power and, you know, really conflict that was unmatched elsewhere in the red state walkouts.
Now, the way you did this is I think, quite appropriate for the area of the social movement scholarship that you're coming out of. But it involves some different approaches to the material. How did you do this? What was the way that you got to these groups and these people that were involved in these strikes? I can imagine the trepidation that many of them face simply getting involved in politics, let alone speaking to, working with somebody who's going to be a study of this and reporting on it as well. So how did you do this work?
Yeah, so I was wearing a few different hats, and that helped. I was on the ground in each of these strikes as a reporter for Jacobin Magazine, and that, I think, allowed me to integrate myself into the rank-and-file networks of teachers in a way that would have been harder had I just been in their eyes, just a scholarly researcher. But because I was able to build these relationships with people after the strikes happened, I was able to go and do a lot more interviews and more systematic research, basically, that formed the background for the book and hopefully my dissertation as well. And it was those relationships I was able to build, I think, won enough trust that people knew that they could, you know, speak freely. And they gave me access not only to, you know, their meetings, but even the secret Facebook groups that really served as the main organizational and communications hubs for these strikes. So I just had this amazing data set, I still do, of literally hundreds of thousands of posts and comments in which teachers are sharing with each other their fears, their hopes, their questions about organizing. So, you know, it's a really, really dense and interesting research avenue to, you know, continue to explore, I think.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and what did you learn about their hopes? From a distance, we might assume these are primarily focused on pay issues. What forms the basis of the claims and the agenda and the reasoning for the political movement, including strikes? What were they asking for in these cases?
Well, it's certainly the case that low pay was a central grievance in a lot of the red state strikes. But the media, the mainstream media at least, is really over-focused on the question of pay. And it was always the case that in all of the strikes, pay issues were combined with a whole range of other equally important grievances and demands and hopes. For instance, just the ability to be able to teach and provide a decent education to students was really a central issue, because schools have been so underfunded for so long that a lot of teachers just felt that they weren't able to do their job. You know, and as a former teacher, I can attest and to the fact that a lot of teachers see their work really as a mission. They could get paid more doing something else given their education, and they want to be good teachers. But that's been so difficult, particularly in recent years, because of the underfunding of schools, and then also because of this extreme privatization and corporate education reform agenda. And it was that real attack on just the education as a profession underlay, I think, a lot of the demands and grievances. So you saw strikes fight not only for pay, but for more funding for students, for counselors and nurses, for really reinvigorating the public education system as we know it. And so it really went a lot beyond pay.
Now, at the same time, one of the really interesting parts of the book is how you talk about the way these different groups came together. And you write, at one point in the book, and I'll quote from it, had educators attempted to make broad ideological agreement a precondition for unity in action, their movements would never have gotten off the ground. How does ideology and these coalitional issues factor into these specific strikes and this action? Were these multi-party strikes? Were these ideologically diverse? How did they work on that side of this? Because you're talking about places that have some pretty extreme politics right now. So maybe you talk about that part of the book.
Sure. The reality on the ground in all of the strikes was that the walkouts brought together people who voted Republican, people who had not voted at all, some of whom were Democrats, some of whom were Bernie Sanders supporters, including a lot of the prominent leaders. So you had a really wide range of political backgrounds for the participants. And so given that, the organizers understood that for them to cohere a mass movement, it really had to focus on the, you know, the demands that were shared across the board by educators, and not some sort of broader necessarily a political, ideological, coherent vision. So that was the dynamic, which is to say that the watchword and the real motto of all of the strikes was unity. Almost every one of the names of the Facebook groups were things like Arizona Educators United. In West Virginia, it was West Virginia Public Employees United. There was this sense that really the cutting edge question to win was to unite across people's very real geographic, political, ethnic divisions to fight for education. And I think they succeeded in a really amazing way. And in the process of the movement, people's opinions changed. So, for instance, there was this whole slew of Republican educators announcing that they would never vote Republican again because the people they had voted into office were attacking them. So there is, I think, a lot of truth to the idea that people learn through struggle. And we saw that because the movement itself was based on trying to bring in as many people as possible from the get-go.
To what extent was this a multi-state or multi-location movement? Were the activists in West Virginia talking to the activists in Arizona and Oklahoma, or were these state-specific in a more important way?
Well, the first thing to say there is that West Virginia was the catalyst. So there's no way you would have had the Oklahoma or Arizona strikes in 2018 had it not been for West Virginia and the example that it generated. Because the reality is, for most educators across the country, the normal sense of things up until very recently was resignation. Things are getting worse, but there's very little we can do about it. The teachers' unions were just continuing to lobby the politicians relatively ineffectually. And so West Virginia changed that. And the organizers I spoke with in Arizona and Oklahoma were very open and conscious about trying to really replicate the energy and, in some ways, the organizing model of West Virginia. And they did, in fact, have a good amount of communication with each other, particularly Arizona and West Virginia. There was a lot of, you know, Facebook messaging, conference calls. They met at the Labor Notes Conference, which is sort of like a left labor conference. Everyone got together. So I do think that there was a pretty impressive amount of cross-pollination, which has continued to this day as far as trying to build a national educators network, and not just in the red states, but with blue states too.
Now, these strikes and worker action played out differently in each one of these different places. But what were some of the gains? What were the outcomes? What happened as a result of these different actions in each one of these states?
Well, the short version is they won, which is exciting because labor unions, as most of your listeners probably know, have been on the decline for at least four decades, if not longer, in the United States. So the strikes won really more in the span of 2 months than the educators' movements in these states had won in the span of really two decades prior. Oklahoma, for instance, hadn't seen a single tax increase to pay for pay raises, and hadn't had a pay raise for educators in 10 years. And they won a 15% pay raise in Oklahoma, 20% pay raise and extra school funding in Arizona, a reversal of some of the tax cuts, a stopping of various privatization initiatives in Arizona, in West Virginia. The West Virginia strike, which really launched everything, defeated an attempt to exorbitantly increase the healthcare costs and impose a really draconian new healthcare plan on educators. They won big pay raises. So yeah, we're talking about, you know, very successful actions. Although, you know, in the grand scheme of things, the demands they won were still, you know, fell short of a systematic transformation of the school system. But they certainly were felt to be and were in fact victories for educators.
And about moving forward, these are specific cases. There were other strikes in other places, famously in Los Angeles. But what about the larger sort of gains for educators nationwide, and the role that this this organizing is going to play in future elections, for example? Have the lessons been learned? Have they been transmitted more widely across the country? Are teachers going to be active in the 2020 election using the same kinds of organizing strategies, if not political tactics?
Yeah, I think that all indications are that the strike wave and the teachers' movement only continues to spread and that there's no sign of it abating. So just this last year, for instance, you saw a whole slew of new red states have walkouts. Places like South Carolina joined. Tennessee has seen a movement and beyond. But I think most importantly, you saw the strike spread to, as you mentioned, Los Angeles, but not just Los Angeles, Denver, Oakland, Chicago. There's a real sense that this is a national movement that has changed the political conversation about the crisis in public education. And in some ways, that's the big win so far, is that because of the strikes, the narrative that really was hegemonic until very recently has been punctured, which is to say that the old line, if you listen to either the Democrats or Republicans in the mainstream media, was that the crisis in schools is due to the public sector being less efficient, greedy teachers, obstructionist unions. And because of the strikes now, you have that narrative really has shifted dramatically. So now there's a general sense that teachers aren't getting paid enough, that schools are underfunded, and that we need to reinvest in public education. And I think you can trace that to the strikes. And that raises real questions for the 2020 presidency, because but frankly, education is one of the most important and one of the most popular planks across the board, whether it's Republican, Independent, or Democrat. And who can frame themselves and in fact be the education candidate is going to go a long ways towards winning the most important unions in the country. The labor unions, teachers are the strongest in the country. And I think in capturing the spirit and energy. And so far, the one candidate that I've seen really be most proactive about this has been Bernie Sanders, who's really been systematically trying to support the teachers' movement and just issued a few weeks ago a very comprehensive plan called the Thurgood Marshall Plan to put a moratorium on charter schools, desegregate the school system, a whole slew of related demands. And so he's, you know, clearly attempting to position himself as the education candidate. And it'll be interesting to see whether other candidates follow suit.
Yeah, the book again is Red State Revolt, The Teachers' Strikes and Working Class Politics. Eric Blanc is the author. Verso is the publisher. Eric, thank you so much for your time today.
Great. Thanks for having me on.